The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Hey folks, I challenge you to think of at least one thing you no longer do that you wish you could. Do you miss like playing golf, maybe long walks with your spouse, sleeping through the night? Are you ready to start living without pain? My colleagues and friends, Hugh Hewitt, Dennis Prager, Mike Gallagher, have been talking about their own successful experience with Relief Factor, and you can add Eric Metaxas to that list. Relief Factor is changing the lives of tens of thousands of Salem radio listeners by reducing and even eliminating daily aches and pains. ReliefFactor.com is full of great success stories, and now I am on board. For just $19.95, Relief Factor is offering a three-week quick start that could help you live your life with little to no pain. Go to ReliefFactor.com to see testimonials from folks all over the country. I love reading them. Over 70% of those that try Relief Factor continue as a customer. Feel the relief and get back your independence and freedom from the aches and pains of everyday life. Go to ReliefFactor.com. Read the testimonies. I tell all my relatives to take it. ReliefFactor.com.
To the Eric Metaxas Show.
I shouldn't tell you this, but Eric hired someone who sounds just like him to host today's show. But since I'm the announcer, they told me. So I am telling you, don't be fooled.
The real Eric's in jail.
And welcome.
Hey, folks, it's the Eric Metaxas Show. Thank you, Todd, for that lame intro. We've got a lot of exciting stuff. Albin, Chris, James, we've got a lot of exciting stuff. Right now, first of all, we have Sadar's Radar coming up in hour two. Albin, you've got a lot of like amazing things that you want to share during this time.
I do, but
Christmas miracles.
Yes, but I have a quick request for folks out there. Look where I am. Please, please, please.
Oh man.
Thank you.
Sure. We're all in our respective bunkers here, so it's hard to hear each other talk. I apologize. You've heard of a Christmas miracle. Albin is going to share with us a COVID-19 miracle. Very, yes. Very special. Chris, you are going to share with us today. You have some intelligence, I guess. I don't know where you got it, who patient zero was. I believe it's in the Wuhan province, but you have some more specifics on that. Later this week, of course, we get another Ask Metaxas. We're going to have John Zmirak this week. But today we have Mary Eberstadt. She's unbelievable. So we have her in both hours. She has a new book out called Primal Screams. That was taped in the gorgeous studio 2 weeks ago before the lockdown. So we've got Mary Eberstadt in both hours today. And I want to say we got a couple of things we're going to cover real quick here. First of all, Albin, Chris, yes. And James, I'm not going to involve you in this because I don't want to embarrass you. But the question is, yesterday was the Sabbath.
Yes.
What did you do on the Sabbath? I'll tell you what we did. The Sabbath, I never took the Sabbath as seriously, but like when every day is the same, when every day feels exactly the same, having a Sabbath becomes the more important. And so yesterday, we knew that we were going to watch some videos, some sermons. We were going to have some prayer times and stuff. I tweeted out that Jack Graham in Dallas had a service. My friend Greg Laurie had a service. There were a number of wonderful things you could choose from. Franklin Jensen, my daughter listened to Franklin Jensen's sermon. But we listened to a guy named Mike Thompson in Las Vegas. He's kind of out there in a good way, but it was just an amazing thing. And then I went for a run, and the streets were utterly deserted. I mean, to be in Manhattan on a cool, bright March, it was March 22nd yesterday, day, afternoon, and to have no one out, to have virtually no cars out. So I made a video as I was coming home. I crossed the median at Park Avenue, and I made a video. I posted it on Instagram and on Twitter, and you can watch that and see what happens with the police car at the end of it. I'm not going to surprise it. But if you're not following me on Instagram or Twitter, I cannot help you. Chris Himes, what did you watch? Did you watch the sermon yesterday? Did you and your family who live in a shoe, did you celebrate the Sabbath?
Yes, we did. We watched Church of the City, which has the amazing website, church.nyc. John Tyson is the pastor there, who actually I think may be a little bit sick, but he kind of powered through it. He only coughed once, but on Instagram leading up to it, he did some videos where he looked pretty bad. So I was a little worried, but somehow wow. he seemed unaffected. So that was really great.
Wow. Alvin, did you and your current wife manage to celebrate the Sabbath in any way?
Oh, we did. We did. In the morning, in the earlier hours, we actually went running in the Rockefeller Preserve. And there were a lot of people, a lot of families even out in the
Sabbath?
Rockefeller Preserve. Yeah, on the Sabbath.
You went running on the Sabbath?
We didn't go running. We went walking. But we had about a half hour prayer time. We do this every time we walk through the preserve. We have like a half hour prayer time. In the evening, we watched a Charles Stanley sermon. And in the beginning of that, they had the wonderful musical group named Greater Vision. And they sang a song that's very clever. They sang a song that's titled God Doesn't Care. And the lyrics were just brilliant. It was really about your sin and your sorrows and the things you did in your past. God doesn't care. He doesn't care about that. He loves you despite all of that. So I thought it was a brilliant song, beautiful lyrics and music. Greater Vision sang that, and a great message about the seven ways to be, you know, get deeper in love with God and be a better man, woman, and Christian.
So you're saying that the God of the Bible is not a bitter judge who keeps a record of our wrongs and is looking forward to whacking us on Judgment Day? Is that what you're claiming?
Wait, what's this Bible? What's the Bible? What is that?
Well, Khalil Gibran, Guy Bible, you know, whatever people read. It's all cool, man. Okay, so seriously, the problem with this format, this bunker video format, is that sometimes we can't hear each other. Like I'm talking and somebody else is trying to talk and I actually can't hear that person. So it sounds like I'm ignoring them, or actually I am ignoring them, but I don't mean to ignore them. And Alvin, the other day, I said, you were cracking some jokes.
Yes.
And I said, now is not a time to joke. And when I said that,
yes,
I was joking, but a lot of people didn't realize that. They thought I was rebuking my funny friend, Albin. And I just want to be clear that when we say now is not a time to joke, what we really mean is now is a time to joke. That's called holy sarcasm. So, Albin, when you were wearing your cute tinfoil hat and when you were joking and I said it was not a time to joke, that was my almost funny way of saying, actually, it is a time to joke. So I just want to be really clear on that. Also, I want to be very clear when I say that joking is now racist. So keep that in mind.
I had to, just so everybody knows, I had to explain that to a couple of very good friends of mine. They were like, how come Eric's coming down on you? I said, no, he's joking when he says he's not joking.
Yeah, I had that problem in my real life. So I have to be careful. I have a Mo persona sometimes that comes out. And Mo, of course, was supposedly being funny while he was being Mo. But, you know, sometimes you just don't know. Is it real or is it Memorex? We don't know. Okay, so Sadar's Radar is coming up in hour two. In a few minutes, we've got Mary Eberstadt. We've got Mary in both hours today. Her new book is Primal Screams. She's an amazing writer, folks. She's an amazing thinker. Very, very important. I also want to mention... Chris, you said that I don't know how you did this, but that you figured out who patient zero was in the Wuhan province. Is this real?
Well, like a lot of people out there, I've been spending too much time on my phone. If I can't sleep, I'll get on Twitter. So really take it with a grain of salt. But I did read something the other day that said the patient zero had been identified in Wuhan province, and they only had a name. They didn't have a location, but the word on the street is his name is Chu. So take it for what it's worth.
Chu.
Yes. Yes.
I think.
It's Twitter, though, so you never know.
Yeah, so that might not be true, actually.
I just Googled it. I Googled it. It is true.
Really?
Chu. Yeah, first victim. Yeah.
It's interesting because I remember the Spanish influenza that was started by a guy named Hawk Tui. Well, that's what happens. You know, you have to be very careful in spreading germs. Okay, so we've only got a minute left before we go to Mary Eberstadt.
Don't forget, food for the poor. Food for the poor, my friend.
Yes, food for the poor. We've raised, I think, $35,000. We still have a long way to go. So I want to say, folks, if you have not yet given a food for the poor, there are people far more struggling far more than we are right now. And I want to say, if you can find it in your heart to give anything to the folks at Food for the Poor, you go to our website, metaxastalk.com. It's on the internet. The internet is on your computer or perhaps your phone. You go to metaxastalk.com. You click on the banner for Food for the Poor. Anything you give, we are grateful for anything you give. $80 feeds a kid for a year. $320 feeds a family for a year. Some of you have been really generous. I want to say thank you so much. But to all of you who've given anything, I want to say thank you so much. It's very, very important. We're picking a grand prize winner every single week who is going to get visit to the studio, whatever, and it's transferable. If you can't come, you can send friends or whatever you want to do. We're out of time right now. We're coming up with Mary Eberstadt, and in hour two, we've got some crazy stuff. Sadar's Radar coming up. Don't go away.
Just yesterday morning, they let me know you were gone.
How lucky can one guy be? I kissed her and she kissed me. Like the fella once said, ain't that a kick in the head?
I don't know what fella he's talking about, but I don't care because I'm sitting here right now with Mary Eberstadt. I have wanted to get Mary on this program, in the studio, and today, I got her. Mary Eberstadt, welcome.
Thank you, Eric.
It's so wonderful to have you. Look, we've got a lot to talk about. You've written many, many wonderful, important books. The new one is called Primal Screams: How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Now, that's the sort of thing I would think, I know if I spent some time thinking about it, I might be able to figure out where you're coming from. But why should I do that when you're right here? Tell us, how did the sexual revolution create identity politics?
Well, let's start by taking a step back from the news cycle, Eric. If we do that, I think we see a remarkable fact, which is that our age is characterized by a crisis of identity. We have gender identitarians, we have racial identitarians, ethnic identitarians, political identitarians like feminists, and we all know that this is playing a major role in our politics now. My question is, how did this come about? How did identity politics, something that was in its infancy in the 1970s, come to be at the center of the American political order? And my answer is that we have been rocked by radical social transformations since the 1960s that have been accumulating. We're talking about things like fatherlessness, abortion, broken homes, etc. The litany is familiar, but what I'm doing with it is saying that it's now reshaping our politics because we live in a world where a lot of people no longer get their identity from the family because the family is too weak for many people. And that, I think, is what's driving this frantic attempt to latch on to these groups that serve as substitutes for the family.
It strikes me that it's a chicken or egg kind of thing because it goes round and round in the sense that I seem to have gotten this idea that it's cultural Marxism, meaning that if we can divide people, you know, the haves and the have-nots, that's, you know, the old-fashioned kind of Marxism. But when that doesn't work anymore, how else can we divide people so that they're at each other's throats and we can make hay with it? And it seems that this kind of splitting people up into these identity groups is a similar thing. In other words, we've got the whites versus the non-whites, the men versus the women. There are all kinds of ways that someone, and the someone is the folks on the radical left, can profit from the innate sense that we all have of, you know, wanting to distance ourselves from other groups, that tribalism that's part of original sin that we all have. It seems to me that the left has capitalized on this, and that when, you know, when communism it didn't work, when the Soviet Union fell and so on and so forth, there was a shift into this kind of identity politics.
So I think we're both right. I think what you're giving is a demand side answer to the question, where does identity politics right. come from? And I agree with you that there are people who cynically exploit all the rootlessness out there in order to gain political power. But what I'm looking at is the supply side. How did it come to be that so many people genuinely don't know who they are anymore? How did it come to be that we have these demonstrations on campuses where students duct tape their mouths shut and stomp around and give every sign of having participating in some kind of collective psychiatric hysteria? I think how it's come to be, again, is that the old ways of answering that question, who am I, are off limits to a lot of people now. There are two ways of answering that question traditionally. One, by virtue of my religion. As a Christian would say, I'm a child of God, right? That's the most fundamental fact about my identity. It's not my skin color. It's not my sex. It's nothing else. It's that I'm a child of God. That's my identity. Well, we all know that we're living in a time of declining organized religion, so that answer is off the table. Now, what about the other way of answering it? That would be to say, I'm a mother, I'm a sister, I'm an aunt, I'm a cousin, etc. We answer it by reference to our place in a familial order. Post-1960s sexual revolution, a lot of people have had their world rocked that way. Is that my brother? I don't know. Is he my half-brother? Is he my step-sibling? Does that count as my brother? What if my parents divorce? Does that count as my uncle over there if they're not together anymore? These questions, multiplied many times, are what are contributing to this crisis of identity. So cultural Marxism, I agree, is there, but it only goes so far in explaining what we're seeing today.
Well, right. And that's why I was saying it's a chicken or egg kind of thing, because you go round and round. Which is it? It's both. It's everything. In other words, you're talking about this kind of breakdown, which leads to the opening of exploiting this kind of thing. But I guess I would argue that when this was happening in the 60s, that it was cultural Marxists, whether they would have labeled themselves or not, probably not, who were nonetheless pushing for this. In other words, that they were pushing for this already in the 60s. It's not something that just happened, that they seemed to sense that this is the way forward to the kind of future that they're looking for.
Well, Marxism has always had a problem with the family. Any totalitarian system has a problem with the family because the family, when it is robust, is such a source of gravitational power, and therefore it must be eradicated or at least attenuated somehow. But again, I don't think intentions, even the worst intentions, explain quite how we got to where we are today, where we have people who don't know whether they're male or female. We have people who have such a feminist identity that it amounts to hating everyone who isn't a feminist. So this is what I'm exploring in the book, is how things got to the past where we know they are, where everyone's at each other's throats, and our politics is more divisive than ever before. I think what we have to understand is that many people identify with these political groups with the same primordial loyalty that most people would put toward their families. And the reason they bring that loyalty to a political group is that the family no longer has that gravitational pull for many people. Look, it's partly a numbers game. Families are much smaller. The extended family is much smaller. And every one of those radical changes since the 1960s that I mentioned earlier amounts to an act of subtraction. You know, abortion, fatherlessness, think about it. These things take people out of other people's lives. And the result, I think, is ironic and also tragic, because we have possibly the most sexually experienced generation in history on the national stage today. And yet, in another way, our society is deeply familially and religiously illiterate in ways that it never was before.
Oh, there's no question about that. I'm still fascinated with the roots of these things, how these things come to be. In other words, even if you think about the sexual revolution, How did that come about, right? What are the antecedents? Obviously, there's a trickle-down effect in culture, right? We know that the cultural elites in the 20s were already debased, anti-family, but they didn't really have the cultural upper hand yet. It trickled down so that by the time you get to the 60s, it can enter the mainstream. But if you look at the 20s in Europe, even the idea of being proud to be, you know, from your country. World War I sort of made it possible for a lot of the elites to say, you know, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori is a despicable idea. It's these old leaders that want to maintain control, and we've got to break free from that. And so in a funny way, you know, you get that 40 years later in America with the Vietnam War and so on and so forth, the idea of loving America, which was completely taken for granted up until a certain point. Like, everybody loves America. Something happened. And so your identity as an American, your identity as somebody who bought into a certain number of ideas, that was fractured in the 60s at the same time that the sexual revolution came. So there's so many different things going on, but there is no question, as you say in your book, all of this led to where we are right now, which is a madness of fracturing that, what do you call them? Identitarians. Where do you see it going, Mary? Because that's, I think most of us who look at it think it's madness and it can really not go anywhere.
Well, politically, it may be the case that identity politics loses the election once more for liberals and progressives. And so I think you might see a rethinking of it at the political level. But my concern with it is much deeper. It's the pernicious effect of this kind of fracturing over time. This is what has led to cancel culture again.
Okay. I just realized we're going to a break. We'll be right back, folks. I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt, the new book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. Don't go away. Hey, folks, that's Supertramp. I'm Eric Metaxas. We're talking to Mary Eberstadt. And, Mary, your website is maryeberstadt.com.
Yes,
what
Eric.
A coincidence. Marvelous. Mary Eber, if people can spell Eberstadt, Mary Eberstadt, Eberstadt, that's the German, .com. We're just talking about everything, how we got to this point to have this madness of identity politics. And you say it started in the sexual revolution and it has led to where we are now and cancel culture. So talk about that.
Well, as a historical matter, the term identity politics comes up in 1977. It's used for the first time in a document written by radical black feminists. And what they say in this document is, we are going to band together because we can't trust anyone else to have our back. They go on and they complain about the men in their lives and how unreliable they are. So this is clear evidence that the sexual revolution is what roots identity politics, because this document, which is a very sad document, amounts to saying we don't trust our families to have our backs anymore. We have to rely on each other because we're the only people we can rely
upon. The sisterhood.
The sisterhood.
Yeah.
And then this spreads as more and more people feel like they can't rely on their own for support. And so where cancel culture comes in is not the surprise that we sometimes think it is. Cancel culture basically says, you can't understand me and you're committing an injustice against me unless you are part of my victimized group. Again, this goes straight back to a declaration in 1977. Why is that significant? Because it shows that identity politics isn't politics as usual. You know, often people on the left will say, everybody's always banded together in collectives to get their political point across.
Yeah.
Identity politics is new because it says you are a white man who can't understand me because I am a woman. And that's a new way of circling the wagons. We can see how destructive it is and how antithetical to Americanism it is to divide people up in this way.
It's also very hopeless. In other words, that as a Christian, I would think that God would help me to understand other people and that I would want him to do that and that we would all know that we're broken, that there's a divorce, you know, again, because of the fall, we're all fractured, but that God has a way of binding us together. And if our initial identity is, or our primary identity is in being children of God, it gives us hope with each other. But if you don't believe that, it really does lead to a really bleak hopelessness that says, I'm just going to be with people who think just like me, and everyone else is the enemy, and there's no remedy for it.
Yes, that's exactly what identity politics is. It's a repudiation of redemption because people no longer believe in a transcendental horizon. And that's part of the problem with this. It's not only making people unhinged, it's also making them miserable. And in Primal Screams, I talk about this because these are things the left never talks about. Why is it that there's been a sharp rise in psychiatric problems among adolescents and people in their 20s? Why do people who are millennials report themselves the loneliest generation in America? I'm asking these questions about the mental state of younger America because those are the people on the front lines of these family and anti-family developments. We need to understand where this kind of trouble is coming from.
And this is obviously a Western problem. You don't really see this in the third world or whatever. I mean, in the West, people are having fewer and fewer kids. The leaders of most of the European nations have no kids. It's kind of an interesting mindset because obviously if you have a kid, you instantly think about the future. If you have grandkids, you think about the future. And you're invested because of your love for those kids. You're invested in the future, and you can't play that game where to heck with everything, it's just me and my friends. You're sort of, you're forced, like in a marriage, you're forced to fight to make it work somehow. And it seems like these people are taking their marbles and going home.
Where we see these problems is everywhere affected by the sexual revolution. Every country on earth that has been reshaped demographically and otherwise by that revolution. So let's talk about what we see in old age now, not only in the United States, but in Japan and across Western Europe, again, in all the countries reconfigured by the shrinking family. There's been an explosion of something called loneliness studies in sociology. If you were a young sociologist today, that would be a natural place to look for grants, for research, because it's everywhere. Now, why is there an epidemic of loneliness in the materially best off nations on earth? This is why. It's because the family has imploded. And in places on the outer reaches like Japan, you have as many as 4,000 deaths a week. Let that sink in. 4,000 deaths a week where people die alone and they're not found until later. There is a business in Japan that now goes and cleans out the apartments of these so-called lonelies. These are people who don't have any family. Again, it might look extreme, but it's not going to get better in Japan anytime soon. And we are seeing similar developments in this country. And for listeners, if you want to see what I'm talking about, just Google loneliness studies in any Western nation, Portugal, Spain, Germany, you'll find them everywhere.
We're going to go to another break. Folks, I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. You can go to maryeberstadt.com. Primal Screams is the new book. That's Stevie Wonder. I'm Eric Metaxas, and I'm sitting here with Mary Eberstadt. We're talking about her new book, Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. I have to ask you, Mary, you mentioned cancel culture. Describe what that is for people tuning in. They've heard the phrase. What does that mean?
It means an ever-evolving set of things that you can transgress and be thrown out of polite society for. That would be one definition of cancel culture. It means if you transgress ever-changing, stricter orthodoxy about what can be said about transsexualism, for example, or much else, that you have thereby jettisoned yourself out of polite society.
Well, and this is only possible because of the utter despicable cowardice of corporate America. Let me say that. It's just amazing to me. They don't have the slightest scintilla of courage to say we're going to stand behind this person or that person. The moment there's just any noise, they run for the bushes. So when we're talking about cancel culture, it strikes me, if we're looking at it theologically as Christians, as being demonic in the sense that you identify someone by a perceived sin, and that sin, this is just like in the Chinese Cultural Revolution, you effectively make them wear it around their neck forever. You never say they can repent, they can be redeemed. We don't believe in all the good things they've done. We simply, like, you know, Satan, the accuser of the brethren, we take this one thing and use it as a bludgeon over and over and over and over, and we wipe away anything mitigating. There is something, as I say, demonic about that, because the whole idea of redemption, the whole idea of giving grace, is completely destroyed in what we today call cancel culture.
Well, here's the problem, Eric. Human beings are theotropic creatures. We lean toward God. We are intrinsically made to look for a transcendental horizon. And if you take away organized religion, you're going to invent your own sooner or later. And that's what we're seeing. We saw it with Marxism. We saw it to some extent with Freudianism. And this is what we're seeing in identity politics now. It's not the case that people will believe in nothing. They will find something to believe in.
Well, the problem is there's only one reality in the universe. It's created by the God of the Bible. So if you leap to accept something else, Marxism, of course, is on the ash heap of history. Freudianism, what a joke. I mean, it's hilarious to me that in my lifetime, it went from being something that people thought, hey, Freud, he's been debunked virtually, you know, from beginning to end. I don't know if there's anything that he said that was pushed for decades that anyone takes very seriously. You could say the same about Kinsey and his part in the sexual revolution. You know, he's proved to be a serial child molester. Everywhere you look, these things have been debunked. But before they're debunked, they have so much cultural purchase that they kind of infect everything, and then you can never really go back.
This is exactly what I mean about secular progressivism having created an alternative religion that it refuses to recognize as a religion. Those examples that you gave, Kinsey, I would add the racism of Margaret Sanger, and other people we can think of, are not deposed by the left because they amount to secular saints. And it would be like questioning St. Mark or St. Joseph or a Christian. It's not going to happen.
You could say the same of Darwin in a way. I mean, his so much of his work has been questioned by, you know, his fellow Darwinists, evolutionists. They see more and more and more problems with it. But if you admit it publicly, it's very embarrassing. So they kind of continue with that paradigm. They don't want to lose the paradigm, and if there's bad information, they just sort of sweep it under the rug. But it is funny because it has become a secular orthodoxy, and it's being pushed. It's not true, and it doesn't work because where we are now, you wonder where the folks who are pushing this cancel culture and this identitarianism, as you put it, where do they see this going?
I think they want to win. But I don't think they understand that they can't win by dividing the country in this way and demonizing their opponents in this way. It's going to get better, or sorry, it's going to get worse before it gets better, I'm afraid, because although politically on the national stage, identity politics looks to have a looser hold over power than its practitioners hope, it's very entrenched in the academy.
Oh.
As we know.
Well, there's no question about that. I guess I still wonder, though, it's been entrenched in the academy for a long time. I mean, since the 80s, when I was at Yale, I have to say it's been there, and it becomes more and more overt. But I'm wondering, there was a novel written, there's a good amount of foul language in it, so I can't recommend it to everyone, but it's called Campus Land. I had the author on this program. It is a brilliant send-up of precisely where these institutions are today. And it shows that it is people, you know, it's the blind leading the blind into a ditch. They are destroying each other. And I think we've seen some of this in the Democratic Party recently, that, you know, it becomes the circular firing squad.
Very much so. And again, I understand, I sympathize with people who find this very easy to make fun of, because at the extreme, identity politics looks ridiculous.
Yeah.
Intersectionality and its importance in their theology, et cetera, looks ridiculous. But I think it's being driven, again, by very deep passions that are not being satisfied in the way that we've evolved to satisfy those passions, by which I mean the family and the extended family as the things that anchor you in life, organized religion, Christianity as the thing that anchors you in life and answers that question, who am I? Without those two things, there are a lot of people in America who can no longer answer that question to their satisfaction.
Yes, and that is, it's a horrifying thing. We just have seconds left in this segment. Explain to my audience who don't understand the term intersectionality.
Intersectionality means basically multiplying your victimhood. So if you're black and a woman, you're double time a victim, and you can add on from there. And if you're a white man, I think you're probably out of luck.
Right.
But it's this talisman.
I have a club foot or something. I'm looking for something. I've got all kinds of flaws. They're just not that visible. Well, we're going to be right back, folks. Lots more with Mary Eberstadt. The new book is Primal Screams.
Well, I laughed, but that didn't hurt. And it's only her love.
Don't mention it. Hey, I'm talking to Mary Eberstadt. The book is Primal Screams, How the Sexual Revolution Created Identity Politics. I have to ask you, just have a few minutes in this segment, but we'll hold you on for plenty more. But before we go too far, you've got commentary at the end of the book by my friend Rod Dreher, by Mark Lilla, and also by my friend Peter Thiel. What is that? Why do you have essays at the end of the book commenting on the book?
Thanks, Eric. So Primal Screams advances a brand new argument about identity politics and where it comes from. And the publisher and I were sufficiently confident of the thesis that we wanted to test it and test it in the book. We also wanted to give an example of something that people have forgotten how to do, which is agree to disagree in a civil way. So Rod Dreher is in the book as a leading social conservative representing that point of view in his comments. Peter Thiel had gotten in touch with me about an earlier book, How the West Really Lost God. We had back and forth about that I thought was so interesting. We wanted to invite him to comment from a more libertarian perspective on the book's argument. And Mark Lilla, of course, is a leading liberal, Columbia University. And Mark Lilla had published a short book attacking identity politics from the left. So we thought with this mix of perspectives, readers could get different views on the argument, and again, we were sufficiently confident in the argument that we put them right in the book.
So let's go back, before we go forward, to the argument. No one before really has made the argument that it was the sexual revolution that created identity politics, and if I understand you correctly, you're saying because it destroyed the family, in effect, it made this opening. Is that the most basic part of the thesis?
Yes, the most basic point is that we are social animals. And in the book, I give examples from the animal kingdom that I use to illustrate these points. We are meant to learn from each other And I don't mean that in a prosaic way. I mean that in a profound way. We learn by watching our siblings. We learn by watching our mothers. We learn what the opposite sex is like through robust family life. And again, with the implosion of the family, there's a lot of social learning that is not going on among human beings anymore. And I think we see this very clearly in the Me Too phenomenon, which I have a chapter about in the book. Because in that phenomenon, you have two sets of stories being told. You have men saying, this was consensual, these things that I've been accused of. And you have women saying, this was forced, these things that I'm accusing him of. And you have this in hundreds and hundreds of stories. My point is that the sexes are not even learning about the differences between themselves anymore, because there's been a breakdown in social learning that it's supposed to take place starting in the family and that no longer does for many people. So this miscommunication and this familial illiteracy is reverberating on the national stage.
I guess part of that has to do with the idea that if you have the sexual revolution, everybody is their own agent. And men, I think, very cynically in the sexual revolution said, hey, we can get more of what we want, no strings attached, no marriage, none of that messy, I've got to deal with the family, I can just get what I want and move on. And women were sucked into this lie, and now they're fending for themselves without a brother or a father, in a sense, to look out for their interests, because that would be too patriarchal. And it really hasn't helped anybody, and it leads to where we are today. We're going to have to go to a break. We're at the end of an hour, but we're going to keep going with Mary Eberstadt. Her website is maryeberstadt.com. The new book is Primal Screams.